Model Test 13.
Section A. Mini Lecture.
In this section, you will hear a mini lecture. You will hear the mini lecture once only. While listening to the mini lecture, please complete the gap-filling task with no more than 3 words for each gap. Make sure the word or words you fill in is or are both grammatically and semantically acceptable. You may use the blank sheet for note-taking. You have 30 seconds to preview the gap-filling task. Now, listen to the mini-lecture. When it is over, you will be given 3 minutes to check your work.
Today, we are going to study on statistics. Firstly, let's see the effect of statistics in the courtroom. After the November 2000 election, Americans waited while court challengers debated who won Florida's electoral votes. In Palm Beach County, third-party candidate Pat Buchanan got a higher percentage of votes than he did elsewhere. Was that because the country's butterfly ballot caused many Albert Gore supporters to punch the wrong hole? Lawyers also argued about other claimed irregularities in the balloting. The Supreme Court finally stopped all vote recounts in early December. But if Gore's statistical arguments have convinced the judges, he would have become president instead of George W. Bush. More than ever, plaintiffs must often prove their case with numbers. Let's see how statistics is taking center stage in some other courtroom cases. Let's see the first case whether the defendant is guilty or not. Imagine you're on the jury in a murder case. An expert testifies about DNA evidence. She says that a sample from the crime scene matches a defendant's. She also gives the odds that someone else would randomly match the tested fragments. If the odds are 1 in 1 million, that makes it sound very likely that the defendant is, in fact, guilty. The defense lawyer may try to counter that by saying that in a city of 3 million people, at least 2 others would also probably match. Of course, the defendant was not arrested at random. Almost always, police have some other evidence linking a person to a crime. But the statistics supporting DNA evidence may be just the proof needed to find someone guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, I would like to ask you to look at the cases against unjust discrimination. In a U.S. Supreme Court case earlier this year, lawyers argued over whether a state university's admissions plan unlawfully added points for students from certain minority groups. Statistically, that made it easier for those students to get in. Statistics factors into other discrimination cases too. Suppose Annie claims that unlawful discrimination kept her from getting a promotion. Her lawyers may use statistics to show that workers with the same qualifications were significantly more likely to get promotions if they were male or not in a minority group. If the employer can't show that Annie didn't do her job well, she could then win her case. Age, family history, exercise habits, diet, weight, and other factors affect the likelihood of developing cancer, heart disease, and other illnesses. For years, tobacco companies said that smoking was not the cause of plaintiffs getting sick. They won most cases against them. Then, judges and juries listened to statistical evidence that even when other factors were equal, smokers had much higher disease risks. Finally, some cases started to hold tobacco companies liable or legally responsible. Of course, the plaintiffs had other evidence too. Tobacco companies' own documents show that they knew about disease risks, yet their ads still targeted young people. In other words, these statistics did not stand alone. When using statistics, it is important to understand that statistical evidence complements other forms of evidence. Statistical evidence should be evaluated along with other evidence and not alone. And then how can the court work out the compensation the victim should gain? Statistics help add up damages, actually. Statistics help decide how much people or companies must pay if they are liable. Suppose a defect in a car caused an accident. As a result, Bert could no longer work. Statistics could show how long Bert would otherwise have worked and how much he probably would have made. When two variables correlate with each other, statisticians can often predict one value from another with regression analysis. If someone plotted all the data points on a scatter plot, the analysis would find the line with the best fit through them. But suppose that people in a case claim that nearby pollution lowered property values for a whole neighborhood. It may be unfair just to match sale prices with distance from the pollution, or to compare average prices with another town. After all, many factors affect property values: style of house, size, age, number of bathrooms, and so forth. That's where multiple regression analysis can help. It finds the best fit for all the sample data when multiple independent variables are at work. It nets out the effects of all these things that are different, so that you are comparing apples to apples. You will also know that statistics have the power on the witness stand. Good statistical experts make numbers user-friendly for the judge and jury. Many use high-tech graphics and other tools to present their conclusions. But statistics can be and have been misused, typically when people have interpreted their statistics to mean more than they really do. A good statistician is careful to explain just how reliable the statistics really are. Cross-examination lets each side attack the other side's analysis flawed. Were data accurate, or may they have been biased? What was the margin of error? Did one unusual observation or outlier unfairly affect the outcome? Finally, the jury weighs statistical evidence along with all other evidence. The verdict makes a real difference in the lives of parties to a case and to our justice system. Today we've talked about the magic of statistics working in various fields and events, like in the court, in the issues against discrimination, in calculating damages, and on the testimony. I hope you would have had a good time.
Now, you have 3 minutes to check your work. This is the end of Section A mini lecture.
Section B, interview.
In this section, you will hear one interview. The interview will be divided into two parts. At the end of each part, five questions will be asked about what was said. Both the interview and the questions will be spoken once only. After each question, there will be a 10-second pause. During the pause, you should read the four choices of A, B, C, and D, and mark the best answer to each question. You have 30 seconds to preview the questions. Now, listen to part one of the interview.
Hi, Hannah. I was wondering when I'd bump into you. You know we only have another 2 weeks to complete that essay on modern technology for Dr. Owen.
I know, Terry, but don't worry, because I've been doing some research and I've got some great ideas.
Such as?
Well, it's my guess that most people were right about computers, because that's what everyone thinks about when they hear the word technology.
But that's what technology is, isn't it?
Yes, of course it is. But it's many other things besides.
What, like mobile phones, that sort of thing?
Yes, but what about farming technology? It's as much a part of people's lives as computers or mobile phones.
What do you mean?
Just imagine for a moment if farmers couldn't grow enough food to feed everyone. Then economics would mean nothing because no one would be able to work, or even willing to go to work for that matter.
Yes, I see your point. Like those countries in Africa where people are starving.
Yes, indeed. Therefore, I suggest we write our essay on the development and impact of farming technology.
The development and impact of farming technology. That sounds impressive. Yet farming only began about 5,000 years ago, didn't it?
Actually, it's believed that plants were first domesticated about 10,000 years ago. Although a primitive type of plow and other basic tools were not invented for another 2,000 years. But their invention made it possible to grow much more food and feed a much bigger population.
I see, and that would mean more people could spend time doing other things, such as building houses and developing other kinds of tools.
Exactly.
This is the end of part one of the interview. Questions 1 to 5 are based on what you have just heard.
Question 1. What is the possible relationship between the two speakers?
Question 2. What are the two speakers mainly talking about?
Question 3. What does technology refer to in Hannah's view?
Question 4. Why did the two speakers finally choose farming technology as their research topic?
Question 5. According to Hannah, when did farming technology first take place?
Now, listen to part 2 of the interview.
Do you remember that lecture we had last time on the Industrial Revolution?
You mean when Dr. Owen was talking about the explosion in technology?
Yes, and didn't he mention something about fertilizers being invented?
That's right, he did. If I remember correctly, he said that chemical fertilizers were used so that more food could be grown without having to use more land. and this enabled the Industrial Revolution to take place. In fact, I've got the reading list he gave us. If you like, I can go to the library and try to find out more information.
Yes, and that can form the first part of the essay.
So what do you suggest for the second part?
In the second part, we can talk about the technology that is used in modern farming methods.
That's too big a leap. That will have to form the final part. Of course, I will write that. For the second part, we need to talk about the inventions that were made during the 18th and 19th centuries.
What, like tractors, you mean?
No, mechanical vehicles weren't invented until the early 20th century. But it's important to mention that because it meant that when machines were invented, farmland that was used to grow hay to feed the horses could be used to grow food for people.
Okay, then. So I'll try to find out as much as I can about technology in the 19th century. If you like, I'll also look at the developments in the 20th century.
Such as?
Gene technology, of course. In fact, by manipulating plants' genes, scientists have been able to invent crops that can grow not only more food, but that can grow in places where they wouldn't naturally grow.
What, in places where it's too hot or too dry, do you mean?
Well, I guess so, but I was thinking more of plants that are resistant to disease.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
So, can you do some research into 20th century technology, then?
Actually, I was going to suggest we do that together, given that it's such a big topic area.
Yeah, I guess you're right. We can make that a joint effort, then. This is really great. We're getting somewhere with this essay now.
I think we have enough to keep us going for now. So why don't we go to the library and do what research we can? And we can meet again, say, next Tuesday.
Tuesday's out for me, I'm afraid, because I have a tutorial. Let's make it the day before.
Okay, no problem. What time?
Oh, say 2 o'clock. That'll give me time to write up my findings.
Okay, see you then. Bye.
Bye.
This is the end of part 2 of the interview. Questions 6 to 10 are based on what you have just heard. Question 6. What was the lecture topic made by Dr. Owen?
Question 7. When were mechanical vehicles invented?
Question 8. Which aspect Terry will focus on about the developments in the 20th century?
Question 9. Which part will Hannah not cover in her essay?
Question 10. When will the two speakers meet again?